Welcome to Thursday, the 22nd of June, and welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. In just a few minutes, two African-American mothers will reflect on shootings, like one in Seattle last weekend and another in Minnesota not too long ago, shootings that happen in front of children. I hope you can stay tuned today, and you can always join us on Twitter at KUOW. First, in Seattle's hot housing market, are renters getting a fair shot? Mayor Ed Murray doesn't think so. He's proposing to lower the barrier for potential tenants with criminal convictions. The Fair Chance Housing Law would limit landlords from screening tenants based on criminal convictions or arrests. The mayor and his supporters say it will lead to increased racial equity in housing. Some landlords look at this proposal along with new city rules on background checks, a new first-come, first-served policy, and limits on move-in fees. And those landlords can feel they are losing control over who they are renting to. So let's dig into that right now with Augustine Sita with the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle and Sean Flynn. He's a landlord and board president of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Welcome to both of you.
Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You were both on the task force that helped write this proposed legislation. I'll start with you, Augustine. Why does Seattle need this?
Well, if you look at the number of people being released from the Department of Corrections on a yearly basis, and you look at the data that shows that over 50% of them wind up homeless, with the homeless problem that we have right now in Seattle, this is just adding to the problem. And more importantly, people who have served their time, have rehabilitated themselves, have put themselves in a position to rent a place to live, are financially able, shouldn't be discriminated against.
Sean, someone has served their time. They, whatever mistakes you make, you serve your time. Why not put it in the past when it comes to getting a place to live?
Well, first I want to be clear that the RHA was a stakeholder not only at this stakeholder group.
It's the Rental Housing Association.
Rental Housing Association of Washington. But also that this task force came out of the HALA recommendations, which we also served on. And so while the RHA doesn't disagree that people need to have a fair chance at housing. In fact, we were pivotal in coming up with the name, Fair Chance Housing Ordinance. The question is, does this bill achieve that for us? And we think that the ordinance that we have in front of us, it takes what is already federal law, complicates it. It takes a look back period, which the state required at limited to 7 years.
Look back meaning how long ago was this conviction?
How far long back you can look at the conviction.
And right now it's 7 years?
7 years.
And the proposal is shortening it to 2.
Shortening it from 2 years to from date of conviction. So what that means is if I'm a tenant and I apply to a unit and I've been convicted for murder, theoretically I would have gone to jail for longer than 2 years. So a landlord would not be able to look at that. Okay. But if I'm caught jaywalking, that's going to be available for a landlord to make a determination on. So the problem with the look back is that it reverses what a common sense would tell us in terms of what's going to be applicable.
Augustine, you were on the task force. You're satisfied with the legislation. What about that objection of we're not looking back? We're not giving landlords enough distance from a conviction.
So this part of the legislation is something that I struggle with a little bit at first myself, because I do believe property owners and landlords have the right to know who's on their property. But over time, it evolved. The 7-year look-back period, myself having a criminal history, is impossible for me to find a place that would rent to me. And even though the conviction was older than 7 years, it didn't seem to matter to many landlords. They just changed it to a 10-year look back with a misdemeanor. And so everybody who has a felony couldn't even consider moving into a place. When I started to look at the fact that everybody is entitled to adequate housing, and I certainly understand his viewpoint, but if a person served 20 years in prison for a murder conviction, for example, there's a really low likelihood that that person is going to return, as opposed to somebody who just went in for the first time, who was young and acting up. And so I think everybody is looking at people who have been incarcerated, like we're boogeymen, like we're scary people, and worse off, that we never change. And many of us have come a long way in changing. And if we're able, if I'm in a position to rent, then give me the fairness that you would give anybody else who can pass a credit background check or a financial part of it.
Shawnee's, without getting in the weeds of the Department of Corrections, Augustine is telling you his story to your face and saying, give me a chance, and what do you say?
What I would say is that the federal law already does that. What the federal law requires, right, where there's HUD guidance on this, and without getting too far into the weeds, is that it allows a landlord to look at the criminal history. But if the landlord is going to make a denial based on the criminal history, it requires that they do what's called an individualized assessment. Okay, and what that is it demands that the landlord look at the crime, have a legitimate business purpose for relating the crime to the housing. Right. So, for example, if the crime is misdemeanor marijuana possession 4 years ago, that's probably you have a very difficult time making a legitimate business purpose for denial based on that.
What does it take to make a legitimate denial?
Well, that's a legal question. I don't want to get too far in the weeds.
Okay.
But we'll just say that's one example. Now, let's say meth production would have a much easier case for making a reasonable business purpose because I don't want someone to cook meth in my basement. So the law already says. Has set up a procedure for people with a criminal past to have a fair shake at this, right? It requires, and Bob Ferguson is enforcing this law now. And as we all know, the Attorney General is no joke. And if what the new ordinance does, it says, I can't even see it. It says, it doesn't say you have to have a fair chance. What it says is, I don't get to know it all. And that's fundamentally different.
Sean, you put this in you and other landlords have put this in the context of other restrictions on the ability of a landlord to rent out your property. I mentioned some of them at the top. And Augustine, you seem to acknowledge that, yeah, this is a trade-off. This is a burden. The big picture is more burden on landlords. Would you agree that that's a downside?
So we've never been here, right? We've never done this before. So I can't say that it's more burden on landlords. What I can tell you from my own personal experience and experiences of other people who share a background like myself, when we were given a chance by private landlords to rent, almost all those relationships always wound up good. And those landlords had a whole new perspective on what it meant to rent to people with criminal histories. We're so caught up in what might happen or what could happen that I think it's keeping people from even taking a leap of faith. But what I do know, the whatever ordinance or law is in place now with the 7-year look back, if I went right now to rent an apartment, my conviction's over 10 years old, I'm still getting turned down. And I can't go to somebody and say I was unjustly treated by this landlord because I'll just hear something like, well, while you were getting your background information, I found another renter who was ready to go, so I chose him. And so I've went through those circles so many times. I don't know how many application fees I've paid just to hear the same answer. And even when it's past 7 years, you can Google somebody nowadays to find out if they have a criminal history or not.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, Sean. Augustine mentions we're caught up in what could happen. And isn't it true that landlords have a lot more information than they used to, you know, thanks to Google, et cetera, to technology, that more people are getting swept up who might have a great relationship with a landlord if they just get a chance?
Two things. So what the current HUD guidance says is not just about screening reports. It's any information, okay? So putting that aside for a moment, I think that everyone's for, and this is where I said it the earlier and before we were on the air, that most of what Augustine and I would agree on most things. The question is, how do we get there? And rather than another regulation that attempts to force that relationship to happen, the landlord and the tenant, we were supportive of a citywide CROP. The CROP was a Certificate of Restoration of Opportunity bill that both the Rental Housing Association of Washington and the Tenants Union both lobbied for. It was a big deal in Olympia because we never lobby for the same things.
Mm-hmm.
To address issues around people with criminal records reentering society. And what makes me most sad about the current round of stakeholder group is that we ended up with an ordinance that is punitive and is there to hammer people into compliance rather than build a program that changes people's minds.
Okay. Yeah. Augustine, we just have a minute left or so, so I want to give you a chance to say what's wrong with this Certificate of Restoration of Opportunity bill, CROP.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just it's not there yet. And the process, I know a little bit about it, and the process it would take to get it for some people are barriers within themselves.
What do you mean barriers within themselves?
To go through the process of getting the Certificate of Restoration.
It's too high an ask to force on people.
So let me just say quickly in response to what you were saying, and I hope any landlord I meet in the future is open-minded like yourself, but that's not the experience that myself and others run into. But anyone, whether they did time or not, if he's in a position, if his credit is good, if he's working, if he's making good money, that's not synonymous with somebody who's on his way back to prison. So many of the people that landlords fear renting to won't even qualify financially or so to move in. The people we're talking about is hardworking men and women who have done their time, who are working, who are making a good living and just want a place to live. And they don't want to be stuck with the option of a transitional house, which is almost as negative as being on the streets.
What do you say to that, Sean?
I think this is coming back to the fact that we both have shared goals, right? The question is, how do we implement that? This isn't a question of one side of the table here saying that if you're working hard and you're staying out of trouble and you've got the rent money, that you shouldn't have housing. That's not what the RHA's position is. What our position is that less information doesn't let that happen, controlling the amount of information people are seeing is problematic also in terms of enforcing this ordinance. So if the way the ordinance is currently run, and without getting completely in the weeds, even if you're not Googling, most reports are going to come back 7 years because that's the statewide standard. But then it begs really interesting legal questions around, if I see a conviction that's more than 2 years old, how do I know that I'm not making a decision based on that conviction? This is the whole reason we lead juries out of the court when an argument is made about evidence they can or can't see. The bottom line is that Augustine and I share similar goals. The thing we disagree about is whether this gets us any closer. And I think what the ordinance does is it overly complicates it, and it won't get us where we're going.
Sean Flynn is a landlord and board president of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Augustine Sita is with the Urban League of Metropolitan Seattle. And we've all been talking about this proposal from Seattle's mayor. It goes to city council now to, as I said, lower the barrier for potential tenants with criminal convictions, limit landlords from screening tenants based on criminal convictions or arrests. And we'll tweet out a link to the city's website, details on this proposal, so you, the listener, can follow along, and we'll watch the process happen. Thanks for coming in, sharing your stories, agreeing with each other, disagreeing, but talking this through. Thank you to you both.
Thanks for having me.
It's KUOW's The Record. More just ahead. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. The news broke on Sunday afternoon. In an apartment in northeast Seattle, two police officers shot and killed a woman. That woman, Charlena Lyles, had her children with her. She had a knife. She was black. The officers were white. Since then, local and national media have covered this story, some linking it to the police shooting of Philando Castile, a black man in his car in Minnesota. My next guests, Ijeoma Oluo and Eula Scott Bino, have been talking about the Charlena Lyles shooting. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Ijeoma, you keep coming back to the fact that both Philando Castile in Minnesota and Charlena Lyles had children with them. What does that say to you?
You know, to me, it kind of reinforces that our children don't get to be children.
Right.
They're given less care, less concern, and the amount of emotional turmoil that this puts on them, that someone wouldn't pause and think there's a baby in this car or there are four babies in this house before opening fire, I think kind of reinforces, you know, this is why Tamir Rice was shot as well, because our babies don't get to be babies. And it makes me look at my kids and wonder, you know, when are they going to be allowed to goof off? When are they going to be allowed to make mistakes when they can't even be, you know, bystanders without anyone noticing them and noticing they need protection?
Will you say a little more, Ijeoma, about childhood? Because I assume an officer would be equally reluctant to harm any innocent bystander, child or adult. But say more about how this, about Black childhood.
You know, I think a lot of it is the fact that we simply don't see Black children in our national discussion. We don't see them on television. They don't get to be children, right? We see poor, tough Black boys in these weird fictionalized gang scenarios and things like that. But we don't get to see the nuance of children the way we get to see white children. Our children are looked at as dangerous. They're looked at as tiny adults. They're looked at as future criminals. And it is so painful to see, to look at like my boys and notice, you know, how quickly people seem to be threatened by them. And even when you look at the language, like around the shooting of Tamir Rice, how often the spokespeople for the police said this was not a boy, this was a 12-year-old boy,
right?
And regardless of his stature, regardless of his size, he was a child, he was a baby. And our children just don't get to be, you know, I hear a lot of stories from my white friends of all of the mess ups they did, all of the fun pranks they played as teens. Mm-hmm. Our children don't get to be that. You know, it's hard enough just hoping that your parents are going to be able to raise you in this system if you are a Black child. But then to also know that, you know, our kids can't be impulsive like other kids. They can't act out like other kids without being seen as a deadly threat. There's so little concern given to them in this country. And I think this really reinforced it. I cannot imagine a scenario where you would think that it would be preferable to open fire in a small space like a vehicle or open fire in a small apartment right. with four children in it.
Eula, you've been thinking about all of this.
Yeah, you know, everything you just said was just hit home. It's been studied that we Black boys especially are seen as older, just like, you know, a 9-year-old boy will be assumed to be 12, a 12-year-old boy will be assumed to be 18 kind of thing. And so that, I mean, just everything you said in terms of they're not allowed to have this time to be young in the first place is wild. I don't know. I'm struggling now because I'm pregnant. And so we're not finding out the sex, which is, you know, fun. And I feel like some people are like, oh, I couldn't wait. But there's a real mystery that I get to live in because I have no idea if I'm having a Black woman or a Black man. And either way, it's really scary. But not knowing means it's like I can't picture any part of it yet. Right. Like it's a nice like safety shield for myself, because I think if I knew I was having a Black son, I would worry about all of those fears. And if I knew I was having a Black daughter, I was worried about all those fears. And they all cascade when they do. But it's interesting to be able to kind of disconnect in the meantime and just say, like, I don't know what's happening in there. I don't know what's going on.
That's hard to hear about all that there's all that fear.
Oh,
in
so
you.
Much. I early in my pregnancy, I was really struggling with just like keeping my head above water. And I had one of those calls from insurance company where they're asking a bunch of questions. And I was saying, you know, yeah, I'm pregnant. And the woman was saying, oh, or, you know, how are you doing? But, you know, they always ask, too, if you're depressed. And so I was saying, yeah, I am depressed, like in being pregnant and like knowing I'm going to have a Black child. That's kind of scares me. And she was so well meaning over the phone. She said, you know, but if you raise them right, they'll be fine. And I had to like stall her and say like, no, just so you know, like the chances of me doing everything I can to get them in the right place and put them in the right position in society does not in any way guarantee their lives being saved by any chance. Right. So as well-intentioned as her statements were, it was like, you're literally not helping. And the only thing that will help is if white people start talking to each other. And I don't know. I've really lost faith in the fact that they're going to put themselves in that uncomfortable place. Right. I think that one of the hardest things that I deal with is when I can see how race is uncomfortable for people who do not exist constantly in the concept of race. On the other hand, it's uncomfortable for us, too. And it's weird to me that people don't think it is. I think they think like, oh, but you guys are dealing with it constantly. It's your thing. It's like, no. I'm stressing. Whenever race comes up in a room, I'm sweating just as hard as you are. I wish Black people could blush brighter. Because then they would know just how uncomfortable we are in all these situations. But I think because white people really, I mean, they do show their red, they do feel more uncomfortable. They are, you know, they think that we're not the same in those aspects. And we're not the same in a lot of ways with how we're treated in this country. But we are the same when it comes to like our goals with our family. Like, oh, all I want is this kid to be safe, man. and to play and to have so much fun. Yeah, and then to make a bunch of mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. Ijeomik, you said that you've seen people feel threatened by your kids. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, for a lot of it too was just reminding people the actual age of my children. I have tall brown boys, and especially my younger one, who's a little darker skinned than my older kid. You know, I remember 6 months in you know, through him being in preschool, and his birthday came up, and I said, "Oh, he's turning 4," and they were so shocked. They had been operating under the thought that he was turning 6, and they had been disciplining him accordingly and expecting things of him accordingly. And so then they were looking at his, you know, little outbursts, if he threw a fit for the day, as him being like a disobedient black boy.
Is that on file?
I know. And it was one of those things, actually, where it was so bad that a staff member actually called. She was friends with my sister and called my sister and said, "You need to get him out of here. He's being really isolated and picked on as the only, you know, brown boy in this class."
Yeah.
But, you know, our kids aren't allowed to be upset by anything. They're not allowed to be angry about anything without it being shown as like a chip on their shoulder. And, you know, their size, you know, people assume that they are more physical. And studies have shown, too, that even when they take like elementary school teachers in the room and they watch young boys at play, they will identify the same playing behavior from brown and black boys as aggression and fighting that they would, you know, deem to be playing amongst white boys. The truth is that, you know, our boys, they get a little rambunctious, and our girls too, and they're viewed as being violent and being disruptive. And I have to watch them, and I have to constantly try and find spaces where it's safe for them to run around and be kids, and then also be really, really cognizant of, like, you can't do that here. You can't jump around. You can't roughhouse with your brother here. It's going to look like you're in a fight.
Right.
And people kind of clutch their pearls. I've got two boys 6 years apart, and they do that wrestling, you know, pushing out of the way thing. And I see the look on the faces of white bystanders, like, is this going to be a brawl? Is this going to be a thing? Whereas, you know, if you saw two brothers playing together of any other race, you would be like, oh, look at them. That's adorable.
Or it's annoying, but you would never think
that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eula, you've said that we started off talking about shootings in Seattle on Sunday and others. And you said that regarding Charlena Lyles, who died on Sunday, in Seattle, you hope her children leave Seattle.
Well, I don't know if I hope they leave. I was just saying how so often what ends up happening is we do migrate away from where, you know, tragedy has happened and healing hasn't been allowed to happen, right? Hmm. So something as scary as the people who are literally, like, the SPD is such a close to home thing. I was telling my husband today how, you know, it's not Fife County, it's not Tacoma, it's Seattle. It's like the main, you know, city. And so if these kids are being raised with the mindset of like the guardians of the city killed my mother, and if they don't get enough counseling in the meantime between, you know, now and the age that they're able to you know, get out of here, I would get of age and go. I mean, I would probably get of age and say, this is the one place where I, whenever the police show up, I'm going to always have the remembrance that they are here to harm rather than help.
Ijeomik, you used to live in that complex where Charlena Lyles died.
Yeah, I did as a kid. So it was really, I mean, to me, it was very visual because I know what the buildings look like. I know what the grounds look like. And also, I know how many children are there. Mm. And to think about what it's like to finally get maybe a little more stability, especially because Solid Ground is a place for people, for families that were formerly homeless. And, you know, it's for places, people with children.
This is that transitional housing.
Yeah.
Solid Ground.
Yeah. And to know that there are that many children there, that this happened in their home where they were finally maybe starting to feel really safe. And now there's reporters flooding the area. They've got people going in and out. And I know that that area, at least when I lived there too, had a very strong police presence, police rolling through there all of the time. And that likely is still the case. To know then that that's going to be a recurring trauma for those children who, you know, knew Charlena, who knew her children, it just absolutely breaks my heart.
Mm-hmm. I talked yesterday on the air to a Seattle police officer who's also a state legislator, a Republican state legislator. He lives in Enumclaw. And he said a couple things. He said that the social service system failed Charlena Lyles, and he's called for more funding in Olympia. Yeah. He also said, though, that he didn't think race was a factor in this shooting, that these were officers threatened by knives in just a few seconds, a few heartbeats, as he put it. What do you think about that?
I mean, I don't believe that. I listened yesterday, so I heard him say it too. Okay. You know, I think the hard thing is I watched the video, you know, of them and the audio of them kind of going into this facility, and it has to put your brain into a different space when you're going in knowing all of the history behind her situation to begin with. And you, if, I don't know, I imagine, and I, that's
a, but yeah. For people who don't know about her history, are you talking about that she had mental health treatment of some kind, and she had a pair of scissors with that she brandished at officers in the past.
Right. And so walking into that, they're talking about how she had scissors last time, how things had escalated before, and how she ended up in the position she was in. And then all I can think is, I can imagine them thinking in the car, if that was a woman, a white woman the whole time, how do we de-escalate the situation knowing that in the past she's been this upset, right? And how do we figure out how to, you know, properly navigate the situation so that, you know, that we don't get the worst outcome from this? Because, I mean, she's a mother. She's in there with her three kids. We want to make sure that she's okay. And so when we have that conversation with leaving out the word black, it's like everything says go in there cautiously. But then when you think black, it's like, okay, so this is just some person. This is just some, you know, I use the N-word too much, so I'm not going to do it now. But this is just a black person who's inside, kind of like she's back and forth. They have their issues. They have their traumas. They have their problems. It's their thing anyways. Let's just go and, like, get it over with, right? That's a different mindset to walk into. So to say race doesn't play a role, you walked in with the mindset of, like, the worst thing could have happened, and it did, and it's not the worst thing in their life that they could imagine. I think it's, I mean, I always feel like, yeah, it sucks for officers. They killed someone. Like, that sucks. You also signed up for a job where you would get to carry a gun and kill people.
Yeah. Well, it might be the worst thing that happened to them.
I'm never going to be a police officer. Right. I would hate the idea of having a gun in my hand and the ability to make a bad decision like that.
I think it's important, too, to remember that we have to get away from this mindset that it's either cops or civilians, right? You enter into this job knowing that, you know, it should be that your ultimate goal is to protect the civilians that you encounter. And especially because she called them in.
Yeah.
And instead, it is this, oh, what if she got violent against you? The truth is that is a bit of the risk you sign up for. We don't live in a world, and we'd like to act like we live in a world where it's one cop getting killed for one civilian getting killed, but we don't. We live in a world where it is one cop getting killed for eight civilians getting killed. Those were the numbers from last year. Mm-hmm. So we don't have this. It's not nearly as, oh my gosh, if I take a little time, you know, we're going to have this slaughter of police. What we have right now is really a slaughter of civilians.
Yeah.
And 50% of black people killed by police also were in mental distress or had a mental disability. And people not being trained, people who can't see the humanity of black people who are already predisposed to view black people as threats are going to view black people acting erratically in any way as an even greater threat. And the truth is that they are humans and they're scared. You know, I live in the North Seattle shoreline border. And 2 years ago, one of my neighbors, a white woman, was in distress. And she was out in the street as I was walking my kid to the school in a bathrobe with a sword, a real sword. And she was attacking the street. She was attacking fixtures. She was yelling and swearing. I hesitated as to whether or not I was going to call the police because I was like, okay, this is a sword. This is dangerous. But I don't know if she is more or less dangerous than the police I'm calling in.
Yeah.
But my white neighbors had no such hesitation. Before I could even decide, the cops were there. They talked her down. She put down the sword. They got her into her house. They had her take some meds. They had her take a nap. And then they literally picked the sword up and put it back in her house under her couch.
Oh.
I asked them. I said, why are you giving her back a sword? I'm like, I'm really glad this ended peacefully.
Yeah.
But also, can you please not give her back the sword? And he said, well, it's her property. She's not going to hurt anyone. She's more scared of you than you are of her.
No, she is. Yeah. She is more scared of your
black. She is.
Your black
that,
body.
That's the sort of care that is not given to black people acting erratically or in any sort of crisis in any way. I cannot at all imagine that scenario in any police force in America turning out the same way for a black person. And that frightens me because we do live in a country that is underfunded for mental care.
Right.
We do live in a country that does not understand disability and the way people act with disability or in mental distress. And then we have police officers who have this ingrained fear of Black people. You can say you were afraid for your life, mm-hmm. but if you don't examine why you were afraid for your life when you aren't in other situations, then you're part of the problem. It is not, fear of Black people is not justification for murder and for killing someone if the only reason for that fear is that they are Black people.
Yeah.
And if you would react differently, and if you have reacted differently in other situations, you need to investigate why. And this is endemic throughout our police force. It's the culture.
We started off talking about your families, about the fact that you're a mother-to-be. Do you want to end with, is there a conversation you're having within your family that you want to share regarding these shootings, regarding their future safety, all of that?
So for me, I would rather recommend to other people, because the thing is, I'm going to raise my child as best I can with the mindset that I can only keep them safe when they're within my grasp, and you know, I'll try to make a home where they can only party at my place so they don't have to walk the streets and be in danger constantly, because that's how it feels. You know, I worry about
you're going to host the parties.
Yeah. Well, I think most Black people who have the ability to will, because they worry that their children will go out and bad things will come their way, because even if they're Black with a mainly white crowd, they're still going to be the one that ends up in trouble at the end of the night. But there's this great podcast called The Longest Shortest Time that has an episode that's titled How to not accidentally raise a racist kid, something like that. And it does a great job of talking about how we as a society, especially white people, need to talk to their children more about race as early as they possibly can, because kids learn from your silence. And the more we don't talk about our differences, the more they make assumptions of what things are supposed to be. The same way, if we don't break down what the difference is between a boy and a girl, they start to make up things, right? Like I can think of a girl that's like, boys don't wear pants and it's our skirts, and it's like, no one's told you that before, but you've decided that because you've seen people not wear skirts, right? And then you might decide too that Black people don't deserve safety, because even though nobody talks about it, everybody, you can see how they're not safe, but based on the news and that kind of thing. And so then we accidentally end up with these people that are exactly the same as the last generation. The last generation didn't care whether or not we lived or died. So I'm hoping people will listen into that podcast, but also think more about having the conversation. And if it makes you uncomfortable, that's okay. Discomfort will not kill you.
Ijeoma, any final thought?
You know, I think it's just really important that we take time. If you start to get your hackles up listening to this conversation and think, these aren't the police I know, this isn't the society I know, this is the police, you know, this yeah. is the society, you know. Our society has always had two realities based on race, and that they exist at the same time. So the officer who is nice and courteous to you that you look at for protection is the same officer who will view any sort of, you know, even just slight backtalk from a Black civilian as a threat. These are the same people, because we have grown up in a society that says that Black people are volatile and are not as worthy of protection. They're dangerous. They will hurt you if you let your guard down for a second. And a society that says that white people in America deserve to be protected. These are the same realities. These are the same people. If it makes you uncomfortable, you need to investigate that. Look at the history of the police in this country and look at our society and how it functions.
They were created just for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, just for us. It was like slavery ends. We got to figure out how to keep these Negroes in line. We should create a system to do that. Oh, police. Before that, there, you know, when you watch an old Western, they have, bailsmen. What are they called?
Bailiffs
and things like that, because you would just send one person out to go hunt down one bad guy, and they would get, you know, they would cash in for the prize. Then slavery ends, and it's like, we have to figure out how to monitor these people. They're wild.
We'll pause there. We talked to a Seattle police officer yesterday and a Republican state legislator about this. We talked to the former chief of police of this city. If you're a police officer listening, we'd like to talk to you too. We've been having this conversation with Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large of The Establishment, and Eula Scott Bino, one-third of the podcast Hella Black, Hella Seattle. It's good to see both of you again, and thank you for this very much.
So glad to be here.
Thank you.
It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We'll continue in a moment. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Have you heard about the ramming Subaru in Kent? Tuesday afternoon, there's a traffic jam on 516. Cars are backed up for miles. Some drivers started getting around it by using the shoulder. That's not legal, by the way. Can't do that, but sometimes people do. And it's frustrating if you're one of the drivers who are patiently waiting in traffic, like most people, while the impatient, selfish people pass you by and everybody else by. It was all too much for one driver, so she pulled the move. Do you know the move? I think if you're a KOW listener, there's a chance you've done that move. She pulls her car. It's a Subaru Impreza, in case you care. She pulls her Subaru a little to the right, so now she's taking part of the room on the shoulder, blocking people from getting past. Also illegal, by the way. But the driver of a Jeep was not having that. He just swung further to the right to get past her. So what did she do? Subaru rammed into Jeep. 3 times she rammed into him. The State Patrol released photos. The Subaru's got 2 wheels off the ground. It is so caught up in the Jeep that it has rammed. The News Tribune ran the story. It's all over Facebook, including KOW's Facebook page, which brings me to our social media producer, Bond Huberman. Hiya, Bond.
Hiya, Bill.
I see on our Facebook page several KOW fans making references to Tawanda. What is Tawanda?
So I mostly forgive you for not knowing this reference because I know you have never been a woman who has had enough.
That is true about me.
So go back in history to the 90s, Fried Green Tomatoes. It's a movie starring Kathy Bates. Her character is a woman kind of in crisis. And in this scene, she is waiting patiently for a parking space. And right at the last minute, this car full of younger ladies just swoops in and steals the parking space. And if that has happened to you before, you know what follows can only be called justice.
She's ramming the parked car a couple of few 11 times or so, laughing maniacally.
Right. So she's screaming to Wanda, yeah, which refers to this alter ego in the film who represents, you know, women just breaking out of their meek traditional roles and doing something crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I also saw, okay, now I know the Fried Green Tomatoes reference. Thank you. Also, some people were wanting to know why both drivers got cited for the same thing. And I have a story to tell you about that.
Oh, I'm...
Because both drivers were charged with negligent driving in the second degree, which baffled me too. How could ramming a car multiple times be just negligence? So I called the State Patrol and the spokesperson said, well, I wasn't there. It happened at a low speed. And I said, yeah, but ramming a car thrice doesn't seem negligent. Isn't that vehicular assault or something? We went around about it. I said goodbye, and the trooper called us back a few minutes later and said the Subaru driver is now being charged with reckless driving, which carries possible jail time. I'm not saying it was because I called the State Patrol, but that's the update. Any other interesting comments on Facebook, Bond?
Well, Lonnie says, and I'm with her, I must be the Subaru because I thought the fact that the Jeep was also ticketed was the best part of the story.
Yeah, we asked, you asked on Facebook, which are you in this scenario? Are you the Jeep who pulls around everybody, or are you the Subaru who is having none of it and goes full to Wanda?
Another favorite comment is Patricia saying, I am the person filming all of it.
Michelle says, I think I may be reduced to crazy Subaru antics too. The rudeness and self-importance of drivers is maddening. Which had me thinking about the rudeness and self-importance of the Subaru driver. But anyway, everyone's coming from someplace different. A coworker of ours admitted, yeah, I've done that. Not the ramming, but that the pull over and block the scoff laws.
The gatekeeper.
The gatekeeper. And you know, I'm asking, what if they had an emergency? What if they, you know, you're not the gatekeeper? But sometimes I guess we all feel like we need to be the gatekeeper.
Sometimes it's just too much, Bill. You just can't let another person get in front of you.
If you haven't heard the story until just now, then check it out on KOW's Facebook page. We'll be right back with the record. So baby, don't make a move because I'm coming for KUOW 94.9, Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. In high school, David Schmader was one of the theater kids. In fact, he convinced his parents to let some family friends become his legal guardians so he could go to a school 20 miles away where they had one of the best speech and drama programs in all of the great state of Texas. He would rehearse before school. He would rehearse after school. He would rehearse during lunch. He even started taking private lessons from one of his teachers. Not a school employee, but kind of. A private teacher, and Schmader ended up having his first sexual experience with this man. And David Schmader wrote about this for KUOW's Seattle Story Project. He's here with me now. David, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to see you.
So you're a drama kid at a new high school. By the way, when I did it in my high school, it was called forensics. I was on the forensics team.
This was I didn't want to confuse everyone, but we called it forensics too. It's really hard to explain to someone like, so you're performing medicine?
Yeah.
No.
I have to whip my phone out and say, no, forensics has to do with the forum, as in the public. And so you could be doing science for a public case, or you could be doing impromptu speaking and humorous interpretation.
Right.
Oral interp, I think you did. Dramatic interp.
Yep.
Okay. I'm in your world. You were in one of those schools, in fact, that used to kick our butts. So, you know, you were for me, it was Creighton Prep. You went to one of these schools in Texas. When we talk about high schools recruiting blue chip athletes who don't live in the district, you were one of those athletes, David.
Kind of. I mean, that was the thing, was the coach of this swanky school heard I was moving to the town and made it clear that if there was a spot on the team for me, if I could find a way to go to the school. And I know it really was a kind of bleed over of the whole Friday Night Lights crazy competitive culture. And you're like, oh, this everything is applied to this in Texas. I mean, there are cheerleader wars and marching band blood feuds and all of that.
Now, we're being a bit lighthearted about this, as you were at times in your piece. But, you know, this has to do with I had teammates who I figured were gay, but they weren't calling themselves gay. So maybe we should tell our younger listeners about the, as you say, pre-Ellen battle days.
Yeah. I mean, I was in college from 84 to 87, 83 to 87. And in Texas, far west Texas at first and then more eastern Texas. But at that time and in that state, the only right way to be gay was not let anyone know.
Mm-hmm.
There were no role models. It's so weird. The only role models were, I guess, 4/5 of the village people and people who are arrested for crimes. And then, you know, oh, there's a gay person in the public view, but there weren't. We did not have an Ellen. We did not have anything.
It was a tragic vibe, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It was kind of the worst thing that could happen. And it was you making, there wasn't really like out and proud and happy. It was like, let's make the best of a bad situation and just get through this.
Right, right. And now, so this that's the backdrop, and this is the place where you meet this private teacher you're calling Mr. Wagner, not his real name. What happened?
Just like he just offered some sexual favors and was, I mean, there was no violence or anything. It was just like, hey, here's something I could do for you. And I was like, okay. And I've been writing about this for years. I wrote about it in my first solo play called Letter to Axel, and it was written very, I mean, shockingly funnily, but not. It was just like, oh, my first sexual encounter was when this teacher blew me.
Yeah.
And that was and that was the story for a while. And because I didn't feel injured, it was just like, that's a situation. And it wasn't until I was the age of Mr. Wagner and I was visiting my high school and through my 38-year-old eyes saw what a 17-year-old looks like and wanted to vomit. And I realized it was the other shoe dropping, like, oh, this is the vantage point that reveals all the wrongness of who on earth would look at a 17-year-old and think hubba hubba instead of hatchling that needs to be protected. So once
the age of consent in Texas is 17. In Washington State, the age of consent is 16.
Yeah. So it wasn't even necessarily a crime. And it was like an etiquette lapse in a sense. But once I got older, and the other shoe kind of fell when I was a grown up looking at teenagers. And that's what made me want to write it again, because I had told the story once with complete honesty. I figured as a 23-year-old when I wrote that first telling of it, where it was this kind of breezy telling of an unfortunate circumstance. So it was just to write about it again with the full weight of, oh, this is why, of course, the 17-year-old is going to feel flattered. The 17-year-old is going to feel. And a closeted 17-year-old normalizes everything that happens. You're like, if it's happening, it's supposed to happen, and I should pretend like it's supposed to happen because I've got a pass.
And maybe the grown-up knows that on some level, yeah, right?
That was another part of what added to the cumulative grossness that came out, or that I felt so many years later, was, oh, today that guy could have been my first gay mentor. He could have been somebody who would have been a helpful figure rather than, like, another factor of the bad old days was this kind of gay men didn't have many roads to contentment and happiness in mainstream society. AIDS was around and taking out everyone, a lot of people who were out and proud, and this sense of, like, take what you can get when you can get it, and a really ugly time of history when gay men kind of preyed on each other. Because that was another thing that was really isolating about the bad old days is gay kids, you couldn't be friends with other maybe gay kids because it kind of strapped a siren to both of your heads. So you couldn't even have allies. Your allies had to be estranged because they were too big of a tell about your own self.
Right. So I think that was operating in my high school. I think I know what you mean.
Yeah, the two gay kids had to hate each other.
Right, right.
And that's why that would keep you down, because when we finally got progress, it was when gay people came together and were like, stop treating us like garbage.
Hmm. You mentioned, you used the phrase gay, he could have been my first gay mentor. What do you mean? How would a teacher be a gay mentor?
There wouldn't have been a prom for me to go to or for him to talk to, but just even like, I know what you're going through, it's really hard. Maybe like some proto It Gets Better speech about, like, you know, you get to go to college and there will be more of you there and you won't be so scared, or just having, I'm trying to think of all the things I would say to a 17-year-old who was gay. Was like, it's such a different world now, it's hard to even know what the big challenges are. But
wow, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, no, once progress landed, it was like snowball. Just once the light goes on in people's brain, it's shocking how fast it is.
There are openly gay teachers, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Now there would be an openly, there's a gay straight student alliance at that exact same school.
I haven't dealt with this yet. Are there parents who object to any straight, gay, bisexual, like, conversations about sex, mentoring about sex in school, or I guess as a private teacher, but would that be okay?
I wonder. There would be a way to do it.
Yeah.
There would be a way to finesse it.
So what happened to Mr. Wagner?
These are some things I've learned since that story came out, because other students of his have reached out to me and they're like, oh, after he left your school or your town, he went to an all boys private school, Marquette. Mm-hmm. And so that's not good. But eventually he landed in college teaching, so he could still be creepy, but it would all be not such a breach of etiquette and dancing close to the legal line.
Speaking of dancing close to a line, you included something in your story, a reference to something that we don't know happened. There are these allegations that Seattle's mayor had sex with minors in the 80s, and Mayor Murray completely denies those allegations. But you reflected on it as part of this story.
Yeah, there was these are all allegations. We don't know the truth. I have enjoyed hearing what the accusers have said in this. The number of them has meant something to me. But there was a sense of talking about these accusations against Mayor Murray where it was like, it was a different time. It was a different time, which, as I write in the piece, is like interesting on an anthropological level, but doesn't mean anything morally.
And I want to make sure listeners know what you mean by it was a different time.
It was a different time. It was the bad old days, and there weren't prospects and follow this plan and you will be a happy gay man. It was everyone for themselves, and who knew how long you're going to last with the plague around. And more of that sense of just like, take what you can get when you can get it. And that's understandable to me. I lived through that time. But it's also, that's kind of like deep culture talk and kind of like airing our dirty laundry. It's kind of like, oh, when we were trapped in the gulag, we had to eat that baby because we were starving to death. And we all know it happened, but let's never talk about it. And that's kind of like this awful situational historical fact for gay men, and it warped our morality for a while. It was a really desperate time.
Yeah. And again, as you said, that's separate from unproven, denied allegations that we don't know about.
Yeah.
But this is the bigger picture. You said something kind of to Mr. Wagner. Can you tell us what you did?
Yeah. After I had my late breaking epiphany when I visited the school as a grown up and about the same age that Mr. Wagner was when we had our encounter. I really wanted to like cast a retroactive no vote. Like, I would just like to say that, you know, thumbs down on what went down. So I found him and left a message on his work mail, voicemail. Never heard anything back again, which is fine. But I just needed to, just say out loud, like, not cool.
Well, even more than not cool, you were, I think you said you were 16 at the time?
Seven.
You were seven? Okay, so that, I guess that's the age of consent in Texas. So there's not a question. Do you feel like you have any responsibility to be alerting people to Mr. Wagner or helping in some prosecution of Mr. Wagner if there was more than you knew?
If anyone came to me for that, I would share any story whenever. I wasn't up for being the engine of that just because that's another thing that makes me kind of feel for the accusers of Mayor Murray or any accuser. Like, why did you wait so long to come? You're like, to come forward with these allegations. And sometimes it'll be like, it took me 20 years to realize why it was wrong. Or one of Murray's accusers is, I needed my dad to die because I didn't want to humiliate him. It's like, once my dad was dead, I could say this out loud to people and have it in the media.
My dad. So we're still dealing with the different time that's not so different.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finally, any reaction to this piece? Again, you wrote this, I don't know if you wrote it other places besides, I know it from KUOW's Seattle Story Project. But any interesting, jarring, surprising reaction to it?
A lot of my classmates from that time have gotten in touch with me and just wanted to like kind of also say I'm really sorry this happened. And I think it's some ways more shocking for them. The person who we're all kind of fixated on is our beloved actual drama coach who sent me to see Mr. Wagner, who had to have known some of the whispers about what goes on and still was focused on that win and focused on the trophy. So unfortunately, Mr. Wagner was a really good
drama coach. Excellent. I mean, the humorous interp coming from this guy.
And Hitler was such a good painter.
Right.
Okay. and I think it's been pretty disillusioning because our main drama coach was, like, he's a nationally beloved figure. He's dead now. The school theater is named after him, and that's kind of my dream would be, like, if I could do anything, it would be, like, I would love to rename that theater. If I could sue my way into just making them rename that theater something goofy and name it after RuPaul or whatever.
Do you remember the name that you came up with?
I believe it was Castro Stonewall RuPaul's Drag Race Fabulatorium for the Performing Arts.
I think that was it. I think that's the future name of that school, that school auditorium. David Schmader, senior editor at Leafly, that's the POT website. And you can read his essay. It is called My Teacher Abused Me. I didn't realize it until 20 years later. And we're sharing it with you now on Twitter. It's also at our website, KUOW.org. It's good to see you again, David. Thank you for this.
Thanks a lot.
KUOW is The Record. Thank you for tuning in. Hope you can join us tomorrow for The Week in Review.